Hey, how are you guys doing? Hope you're gonna love this episode with Eric Ruskul and Ben Kaufman. Ben Kaufman for the first time on my show. It started off with a discussion on Twitter with a guy named Jurevic, pseudonymous Jurevic, making some statements, really interesting statements, but a discussion got triggered and initiated with Eric Ruskul and Ben Kaufman especially. And let me give you just some keywords because it's all essentially it's about fundamental questions of money, the definition of money as a present good and time preference as a relation between present and future goods, as also Eric Ruskul points out in Rothbard's definition. It's about investment. It's about time preference. What is, when does use value of a money begin? White market, black market, credit. We talked about a lot of things: speculation, hodling, about a bunch of other topics which you can dive into. Just listen to it. I'm gonna post also add the Twitter thread and some other links, useful links to read and to follow up. And also the article of Ben Kaufman, which is called A Monetary Case for Bitcoin, just in case you haven't read it yet, really worth reading. So it's a really rational, logical discussion with the most rational and logical thinker in this Bitcoin space, Eric Ruskul, and Ben Kaufman really making good points and arguments and counter-arguments or asking questions. And, I hope you enjoy this. And let me know what you think and like, share, subscribe, and write me a positive review. Thank you so much.
Welcome to the Total Connector Show. My name is Kevin Devani. This is a very spontaneously emerging discussion with Eric Ruskul and Ben Kaufman. Welcome to my show, Eric and Ben again. Since we already know who Eric is, Ben, would you introduce yourself a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, so I'm a software developer, mostly interested in Bitcoin. I started learning about Austrian economics from that and just focusing on software development in space, mostly with, I try to do some development mostly on BISC, and also try to write a little in the Austrian tradition about Bitcoin and general monetary theory.
So you're into Austrian economics, essentially, too?
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right, so I've been following your discussion. I find it highly fascinating. I do think it is, not just trivial discussion. It's really goes to that. What's the discussion we've been, we've been following and just commenting once in there? Why did this discussion start off anyway? Did it start with this with a comment of the Twitter with its Twitter handle Jurevic, or
no?
It
started with the long rant about how Bitcoin used to be a money and now it's a whatever he said. I don't know. Goes back a little further.
Further down.
I just retweeted. No, you got to go way up. We got to go way up.
Hold on.
Yeah, it's up like 12 hours.
Okay, let me see. Oh, I can't go.
I think at some point the whole point of the thing got lost.
Is it here? The real benefits?
No, keep going up.
I can't go up anymore. Well, why can't go up? Okay, I can't go up. Okay, that's it.
Yeah, I think I'm here.
Can you
go
find
up? Go up to your top. Go up to your top. Yeah. Okay. That was in response to a thread that was I don't know. It's not that important. I can find it for you if you want.
I thought it started off with speculations. Speculation is what gets people's attention.
No, it was early this morning on my.
But yet, if they use the money as a money or maybe fail to remain whole coiners, there's something wrong with them. Can't find it.
Yeah, I guess this was a related thread too. When this is, it's probably you did have the right top there. There was a related thread this morning, and I think they're just not linked. Just two separate posts.
Okay, so what are the questions at the center of the discussion, Ben, Eric? First, I want to understand what the question is. What is the question?
Well, I think this started off with, was this Grivik? I don't know who that is, but I've seen him post and, just commenting that that the early Bitcoiners, sold out too early, and it was a no-brainer trade to buy Bitcoin at, you know, some early price. And I think I just commented that, you know, it's a money and, you know, the current price is the right price and using the money is perfectly rational. And we got into talking about how saving the money is much better and discussing what the difference between saving, the distinctions between hoarding and investing are, and, you know, which one is relevant to time preference. And then somebody chimed in on which one's better. And, you know, I've never made any comments here on which one is better. I personally trying to draw the proper distinctions between these things, because people tend to consider hoarding Bitcoin as an expression of investing in low time preference, which is incorrect. But anyway, that's where it all.
Okay. Well, what is the distinction? Started. What is the distinction, Eric? I mean, can you recapitulate that? I mean, what is the misconception that it, obviously in your.
Okay. These are in some ways terminological issues, right? Like if you have a word like, or a term like time preference, you have to have a definition for it, right? And in the definitions or the explanations of time preference, it's clearly expressed that time preference is expressed as the interest rate, the global rate of return on capital, which means that no amount of hoarding increased hoarding could not possibly indicate a lower time preference, right? It's just the opposite. It's all about lending, investing. So,
That depends on if it comes instead of if the hoarding comes instead of lending and investing, or instead of spending.
There's no distinction. You either have stuff or you lent stuff to somebody. The stuff you have is the stuff you spent on. Spending is an action, but what you have versus what you've lent is the ratio of your hoarded capital to your lent capital, and that is the interest rate. And that's clearly expressed by any definition I've ever seen in Austrian economics. The interest rate is the expression of hoarding, and it is the ratio of hoarded capital to lent capital.
But there's still still, when you save Bitcoin or when you save cash balances, it still both allows for others to use the capital, the available capital in the economy, the available resources, and it increases the value of other people's money. That's still more time preference than spending.
Holding anything is an expression of higher time preference than lending. And the measure of time preference is the interest rate. Holding Bitcoin versus holding, you know, cats, dogs, cars, and houses doesn't make any difference. You're still holding them.
No, so yeah, but Rothbard does make.
I know that many people have claimed
it has been seen in Austrian economics before. So there is a distinction between holding cash balances and holding cats, dogs, whatever, because cash balances allows others to cash.
holding money that does not lower the interest rate. So it cannot possibly have any bearing on time preference. It cannot lower time preference, holding money versus holding a car. That's just not the case. The time preference is expressed as the interest rate. The interest rate goes down the more people lend, invest. It's also the same number. It's expressed as the ratio of your hoarded capital, of your lent capital to your hoarded capital. So, it's just a definition, right? It's the meaning of it. And the only way I could, I guess, prove it to you is go to the people who wrote down the definitions, which is, you know, it's very clearly expressed by Rothbard, who's probably the most clearest writer on the subject. Many people have claimed that holding money is an expression of low time preference. That's just nonsense. Holding money means you want it now versus later. just like holding any asset, and all assets depreciate when you hold them. That depreciation is consumption. Buying is not consumption. Buying is just an asset changing hands. It's not being consumed until it depreciates. So if you buy a car and then you sell it the next day, it hasn't been consumed. It's just changed hands. It's consumed as you hold it, just like everything. It's the lending that expresses the desire to have something later versus now. And that's how you capture time value, and that's why it's called time preference. The fact that an asset may appreciate in price while you're holding it is not an expression of investment return. It's an expression of a speculative return. And anything can change in price, cars, you know, houses. Holding them is not an indication that you have low time preference. You hold them.
And that is decoupled from the monetary phenomenon of Bitcoin. I mean, you're saying Bitcoin is not a monetary phenomenon. Is that what you're saying?
What phenomenon are we talking about? What do you mean by monetary phenomenon?
Well, because it's something new. It's unprecedented. That's what I'm saying. Is it? You mean it's like a totally strict principle, whatever you are defining?
It's
or
just a definition. I mean, it's a well-established principle. What it means is... Mm-hmm. People prefer their stuff now more than later, right? So they have a preference for things now more than later. Having your money now versus getting it later is the same expression. And people want their money now because they presumably want to be able to spend it. They have a certain risk tolerance. They want to have their car now. They want to have their house now. They want to actually have possession of the stuff. That's an expression of higher time preference. If you have a lower time preference, you don't want it as much. Now you're willing to lend it to somebody else and get some more later. And that more is the interest rate, right? That's what you're willing to lend at. So the idea that holding some asset in your physical possession is an expression of low time preference is just completely backwards. Whether the asset appreciates or not is irrelevant. All assets can potentially appreciate or depreciate. It's not consumed until you're holding it, right? This is a commonly held economic error that's not inherent in time preference. It's just a general economic error that buying something is consumption. Buying something is not consumption, right? Buying something is just changing hands. It's not consumed until it's destroyed, which should be pretty obvious from the word consumption, right? You buy some food, you haven't consumed it, right? It's not consumption until you eat it. Right. And when you eat it, you still haven't consumed the energy in the food until you expend it. And now it's fully destroyed. It's the same with anything else. It just changes hands. You know, a car in the manufacturer's inventory is depreciating while it's in his inventory. Right. It's being consumed. When it changes hands, it continues to be consumed. So this idea of selling being consumption is part of the reason why people make this error with respect to time preference. They think buying things is the expression of high time preference, actually holding them, which is when they depreciate.
So Ben, what's can you recapitulate your arguments?
I definitely see what Eric is saying about time preference and how it is represented merely by the interest rate. But I still, so one thing is that I still think that if you hold Bitcoin or if you hold cash balances, you still, it is still a lower time preference than activity than holding anything else, which is not cash, as you allow for others to use their cash, which gets higher value. So that's first.
I don't understand what you mean by allowing others.
So
what does it mean by allowing others?
So when you're holding cash balances, it's like you're just not, when you don't spend them, the value of the cash simply appreciates. The value of all other cash is appreciating.
That's just not true. I mean, everybody always holds all money. All money is always held by somebody. It doesn't make go up.
Its velocity does matter. It's
if you're an Austrian, I think you
does matter.
If you're an Austrian, I think you should probably revisit that idea of velocity of money. You'll find it's widely rejected.
I don't like velocity of money in the common sense, but there is a use for it. I don't like the term. I agree that's a bad term usually. But it is important for the value of money still. Even Rothbard talks about it in some sense. It's still important. I mean, it's still important value of money itself.
Well, I mean, this is completely orthogonal to the question of time preference, but the speed that money moves is not what determines its value. And that's a tautology that Austrians have disproved for quite a long time.
Yeah, and the velocity aspect, didn't it come from Keynes, you know, this whole Keynesianism that they try to, you know, make this a dogmatic principle, like an aggregate spending, aggregate, you know, like velocity, all these terms that it all comes from Keynesianism, right?
No, it doesn't originate there. It's older than that. It comes from a longstanding attempt to determine what's the value of money. And you know, this idea that, you know, the velocity of money is a tautology. It says that money determines the value of money. But it predates Keynes. I'm not a historian, but I know it's older than that.
Yeah, but that's not exactly how I meant it. So what I mean is that basically when people try to lower their cash balances, they try to spend more. This cause the money to depreciate when they try to spend more and lower their cash balances.
Okay. All right, let's just take that as an assumption. It has nothing to do with time preference, right? You can buy and sell stuff from other people, but you're not expressing time preference in any way, and neither are they. Not until you lend it. Each person is getting stuff now. They have stuff now and they're trading it with stuff that other people have now, whether it's money, cars, you know, houses. It doesn't, you know, money is still stuff, right? It cannot change the interest rate unless you're lending, and the interest rate is the expression of time preference. That's the concept of time preference. I mean, I'll pull up a definition for you.
No, yeah, I see your point. But so, yeah, on that point, I guess I agree with you that this is not exactly related to time preference per se. But another thing here in the discussion, which I think I want to talk about, is the development of Bitcoin. So right now, how are you basically supposed to invest using Bitcoin?
You don't have to invest using Bitcoin. I mean, I don't know where that idea comes from. I'm just if people can invest, they can invest all kinds of things. If they want to lend their Bitcoin, they can certainly lend their Bitcoin. If they want to cash it out, get some dollars and lend their dollars, they can certainly do that too.
Okay, but
how do you buy anything? How do you buy anything with Bitcoin? The vast majority of stuff that's bought with Bitcoin is actually converted to dollars and purchased with dollars or euro or whatever. It's no different with lending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'm talking about how does it help to the growth of Bitcoin. So what will help Bitcoin basically grow in size?
How does it help the growth? I mean, the growth of Bitcoin is a consequence of people demanding goods in Bitcoin. So if they need Bitcoin to get things, that's what creates the demand. And people speculate on that demand.
Well, then the question is how do you increase demand then? Okay, then how do you what
how do you increase demand for things
the demand?
Things that are purchased in Bitcoin that people would prefer to purchase in Bitcoin will increase the demand for Bitcoin. People holding Bitcoin in expectation of that demand don't increase the demand. People selling it in expectation that the demand is not materializing don't decrease the demand. The demand is, and this is again another well-established Austrian concept that speculation does not determine price. It only guesses above and below the price, not even helping it get there any faster because speculation is guessing. Only the people who are actually using the thing get to determine what it's worth. People who are trading for it, you know, because they want it. So the only way that happens is if people do it, right? If people want to use the money as a money, they'll do so, and it'll have that value. And people will speculate on that value, and it'll fluctuate widely. But everything gets speculated on. But that speculation always is non-determinative of the value ultimately, right? So the question is, where does that value come from? Well, Bitcoin has a value proposition. It allows people to do things more easily and more cheaply than they can do with other monies. So it's those things that need to grow if we expect Bitcoin to reach the value that people have speculated on.
Well, so what I personally say,
I didn't hear you.
What I'm saying is that what's important for the demand for Bitcoin, what represents the demand for Bitcoin, is not just how many people accept it, but how many people want it as their cash balances, basically to hold it. Like anything, yep. Like cars. The demand for cars is how many people want to have cars. The demand for Bitcoin is how many people want to have Bitcoin.
No, that's not true. People want to have cars because they use them to drive to work. You can't drive Bitcoin to work. You can't eat it. You can't sleep on it. That, you can't live
that,
in it.
That doesn't, right? That doesn't represent the demand for it. There's no.
It has
reason,
no use like, value.
Yes.
It has no use value. This is why economists tried for a long time to figure out what determines the value of something with no use value, right? What's the monetary value? The monetary value is being able to exchange it for something of use value, right? And so people can hold it. But that holding is only an expectation of being able to trade it for something of use value, right? That's right. The only possible benefit you can get from holding it.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that holding it by itself is not the demand for it. So if you have, like, it doesn't matter that I want a car. It doesn't matter if I want to sleep in it, to drive in it, or do whatever. Like, that doesn't matter why I want it. What's important for the demand for car, for the car seller, is that I want it, that I have demand for it, I want to possess it. And the same applies for Bitcoin. If I want to hold Bitcoin,
there's
demand for it.
If nobody can trade their Bitcoin for anything, then that desire to hold it will turn out to be pretty useless. The car, probably somebody can get some use out of. But unless you can trade that Bitcoin for something of use, right, something of better use than, say, the dollars could get you, then it's not got that value.
Oh, yes, but
and that,
but
that expectation is ill-founded.
Yeah,
develop
but,
into
yeah,
the, only
Eric, but,
into its actual utility.
But the reality is, it's already being exchanged for goods and services,
yeah,
already, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the reality. It is already used as a medium exchange. Maybe not, you know, not dominantly anywhere you can't see, but, you know, cars being sold, real estate is being sold. So it's being even loaned out, right, with interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a process already going on, you know.
There's another aspect of Bitcoin, though, that's just being ignored, right? Bitcoin's value proposition is not in, you know, trading on big exchanges for dollars, right? That's not a value prop. The value proposition is that it can be used without permission. It's permissionless, mm-hmm, right? It doesn't accept supply changes, for example. These are, as I've said many times, black market concepts. These are things that can be easily taken away with white market use. So everything we're talking about, for the most part, is the growth of speculation on use that's largely not based on the Bitcoin value proposition, right? So when you look at actual black market activity in Bitcoin, you have actual use cases, right? But you know, taking it and putting it in your web wallet and, you know, trading it for dollars on some online exchange, isn't really building Bitcoin. It's just building a house of cards. So ultimately, if people want to see the value realized that they expect, they have to assume that it's going to be used the way it's designed, which is to operate without permission. Right now, it largely operates with permission. Right. So not only a lot of centralized services, but a lot of predominantly white market services.
So,
you know, people don't want to hear that because they put their own expectations on it. But these are not the expectations that are built into the design, the security model, or any aspect of it. These are just people's desire to make money in this casino, right? Because honestly, there's just not a value proposition in most of the things that's being done with Bitcoin that are being done.
Well, the people in the Bitcoin community, they do exchange, they do already, you know, they do pay with Bitcoin. There's a lot of people in the Bitcoin scene or community, unless they're, you know, they have to pay the bills and the existential stuff, they have to convert, they have to hold some stash of dollars or whatever fiat. So in the expectation, within the expectation that it is emerging as a medium of exchange with a, let's just say permissionless black market. Isn't that also not a legitimate expectation of the value rising in Bitcoin? I mean, I don't know whether I'm mixing up something, but do you know what I'm getting at?
Sorry, you lost me. I do my best to fill in the gaps, but I don't get it.
Yeah, you were talking about the black market. I mean, it's already being used as a.
Yeah, well, I haven't suggested it's not being used. We were talking about what it's, you know, so there's this condemnation of people that actually used it as a money or sold out, right? It's like the using this metaphorical sellout as if it's a literal, you know, I sold my Bitcoin. Now, of course, somebody bought it. Right, there was a trade, so it's not clear how this is a negative and how the person was stupid for using it or somehow wrong for using it when in fact it's a money, right? They should have just held it because they should have known it would be, you know, worth so much more. And of course it wouldn't be worth anything if people just held it. So the theory is just what bothers me, that this idea that this thing everybody should just hold on to. If it's not used as a money in a way that's consistent with the value proposition, that speculation will be for nothing.
Well, it's not just holding it. It's what's important is the demand for holding it. So when you want to hold it, you are willing to accept it, basically. And that's what can drive the actual use of it as a medium of exchange. But you need people to want it, to have the demand for it, want to hold it.
That is the case with a money being used in trade. People want it. That's why they accept it.
Yes, but now because Bitcoin is still emerging as money, not many people want to hold it yet. That's the point.
It's been emerging for 10 years. It's actually a money. It actually gets used quite a bit. Some people imagine it being used.
Not when you compare it to most national currencies. Well, it's not.
It doesn't compare to most national exchange. It doesn't compare to most national currencies because, again, it's not a white market money. If it became anywhere close to the size of, you know, major national currencies, it would no longer be legal. When it starts taking that much tax revenue, inflation tax, and taking away transparency from transactions, then it'll go away. So again, this is why I continue to emphasize
black market money. I mean, it's not even comparing to a black market money or like money laundering and stuff. So it's all much bigger than the size of Bitcoin right now. There's more money laundered than Bitcoin use.
If you look at the current price, you know, the speculation is that right now Bitcoin is operating at somewhere around, I don't know, I just totally ballparked it in the article I wrote, because it's not really about getting an exact number, it's about the process, but you're looking at speculation at the price of say 10,000, estimating that in 10 years it will control about 10, about 7% or 7 or 8%, I forget what it was, of the black market, the estimated size of the black market in 10 years. The black market's about 20-30% of the world's economy, so that's not small.
And how do you get the estimate, how do you get 7% estimation? What is it based on?
You just take the total amount of money in the world.
The base money.
Take the percentage. Money, right? Not credit. Money.
The circulating money, or all the circulating money, or which money is that? Like
money.
Okay. How much
dollars
is that?
Are money? Euros are money.
How many trillions, you know, are we talking about? How many?
I don't have the numbers in my head. It's all in the article I wrote.
Okay.
But it's trillions. But it's not, you know, M3, for example. That's credit. Mm. And credit expands on money based on time preference. And the expansion of credit on money is significant. And people make that error all the time, saying, well, Bitcoin will just replace all credit, which is ridiculous, right? I mean, if you're going to make a comparison, make it with money. It's not credit. If you take the fraction of the global economy that's estimated to be black market, and you just take the fraction of that amount of money, and now you have the estimate of the amount of money that's used in the black market. And then just take the current price and take the future value of that price, in 10 years, and take the total amount of Bitcoin supply in 10 years, and you know that's about what you come up with. Again, these are really gross. The article I wrote are really gross. I'm trying to pull it up right now while I'm talking to you. Gross estimates. It's not about trying to get to an exact number, but showing like what's a rational process. If you're trying to ballpark, you know, what the price is, what are you actually speculating on? Then do this, and somebody could come up with much more precise numbers for these things than I did. But you know, it's in the ballpark. And what you're doing is you're looking at the current price and projecting it forward, you know, up to like 10 years, and saying, well, what would the, given the number of units that are out there at that point, how much of the black market economy do we believe today that will be using Bitcoin in say 10 years? And that's the ballpark figure I came up with, 7% or so, 7.5%.
And based on that,
could be 20, but you know.
Okay. But okay, let's just say it's 7%. Is it possible to derive this future, price per Bitcoin then in 10 years based on those estimations?
Well, yeah, that's implied in the estimate. What is project that? It forward.
What is that projected?
You're asking me to make projections, and this article is about a process for determining, you know, if you wanted to use a rational method for coming up with some estimate of what we're speculating on, this is it. But actual predict, you know, I'm not going to predict prices.
Okay.
And that's why I purposely use very loose numbers, just so, you know, just a process. But it was really meant to show the invalidity of the various techniques that people have used. Like, you know, okay, Bitcoin will be this much because we're assuming it's going to replace M3, which is not only all money, it's all bank credit, right? But it's not even all credit. That's what's strange. It's just some intermediate credit value. So that's just not, there's no rational basis for that. Hold on. So let me see if I can pull it up. If you give me just a second.
Sure.
I was actually trying to pull up the Rothbard definition for time preference, but I'll pull this up now. That's why I'm all distracted. So you could, people have used all these different estimates, you know, tangible money, base money, which is money, bank credit, which is M3 minus M0, or just M3, all credit, bank credit, debt, equity, gross domestic product, you know, all these things have been used. But what I did is I took the U.S. base money, which is Fed obligations, printed and yet to be printed dollar accounting, and took the fraction of the global economy that is the U.S. economy based on market capitalization, which is about 40%. Now that could be done much better. You just go add up all the currencies in the world, you know, all the monies in the world, do it differently. But I just took this really gross estimate and said, okay, the U.S. market is 40% of global markets. Okay, so take the U.S. Base money and, you know, multiply it by 1/40%. Then you take the amount of Bitcoin that would exist in the future, and then you project forward growth, you know, net present value, so the opportunity cost of speculating over a 10-year term. In other words, you're not investing, you're speculating, right? So if you're investing, you'd be earning, say, I think I used a conservative 7.2%. Typically, the global return on capital is around 10%, but use a conservative 7.2% opportunity cost for not investing during that term. And so that implies you expect that you're going to make at least that much on your speculation. So project that forward 10 years, you get a doubling of the price. So base money puts the price at 527.16. The topic's called price estimation. It's in my wiki. Mm-hmm. So you take a replacement of all money, and then take 28% of that, which is the global market, and the base money. So 100% replacement for estimated black market trade, the price would be $73,000 today. At 100% black market replacement, be $73,000, right? So take what the current price is, and so therefore the current projection, the presumption is that the current price is estimating in 10 years that the black market adoption will be 7.4%. But again, really gross numbers. It's just meant to show the process.
So that's the gross estimation. If you take 7% of the black market,
if you're speculating now, right, on future growth say 10 years, and you're suffering an opportunity cost of 7.2% on your speculation, which means you're betting that you're going to make at least 7.2%, which is, you know, a conservative return on capital, then the price that you're expecting in the future comes out to 7.4% of the black market. If you assume it's 28% of the global market, and you assume that the world amount of money is U.S. money is 40% of the world's money, which is probably not quite accurate, but again, just an estimate. So, if you have 7.5% of the black market in 10 years, and the price seems, you know, according to those assumptions, would make sense. Of all, you know, all like talking about all activity. But of course, having if Bitcoin's black market money and you have the white market is obviously something else, Bitcoin can't be all the money used in the black market, right? Because people can't get stuff in the white market. That's what money laundering is, right? Getting your black market money into white market money. So there's clearly not complete isolation there of the two monies. But it you know, it's used like that today. There's plenty of black market activity that happens in Bitcoin, and people exchange out of that into dollars. I mean, the example I always use is, you know, why are there ATMs outside of all the strip clubs? Right? People take their debit cards and credit cards, they get some cash, they go in and they spend some dollars, some euros, whatever, and then they take it home, maybe put it back in the bank, right? Whatever they have left. There's a reason people use these different monies in different scenarios. There's a reason people use credit cards, dollars, you know, coins, whatever. And Bitcoin has a particular value proposition, and it has one that threatens revenue by the state, which is not presumably going to be given up So building things that assume, you know, permission to me are not really that incredibly productive, and speculating on a money that's just used as a speculative vehicle doesn't make a lot of sense, right? So anyway, that was, you know, it was just a few comments I made, but all kinds of other stuff started coming out, like time preference, and have to knock those down one at a time.
Yeah, so I definitely see why you're saying it's black market money. I mostly agree, if not completely agree, because I do think there will be some white market use, but I think the black market is by far its greatest use of Bitcoin. Honestly, that's why I love BISC, for example. But yeah, so I still think holding it does make sense if you expect it to grow, at least. You know.
Yeah, if you know it's going to grow, you should hold it. But it's called speculation for a reason. You don't know, because if everybody knew, the price would just be higher, and then it would be fully speculated. The question is, when is that? It's hard to know, right? I mean, speculation isn't the bet that the price is going up. Speculation is a bet that the current price is wrong, mm-hmm. right? That people haven't priced in that knowledge yet. Well, exactly. When is it all priced in? How do we know? The only way to know is when the actual utility of the money is expressed, right? And that does happen.
Yeah, so speculation is the realistic demand, the realistic expectation of an uncertain event or uncertain growth potential in the future, which I haven't calculated in right now.
Well, it's speculation is always speculation on utility, right? There's usefulness of everything that people want and have, right? Money, if you have a pure money, a fiat money, which means no use value, you can't make it into jewelry, you can't smoke it, whatever, it's just used for trade, then the only utility is in trading it for other stuff. And speculation is always on utility, and inherently speculation is what's not known, right? What's known is already in the price, right? The price is the market's current best estimation of the utility for the future, but it can be completely wrong, right? Utility itself has to be expressed at some point. So, the speculators will speculate above and speculate below utility, and they always do. That's a zero-sum game, right? Somebody takes one side of the bet. Like, for example, in Bitcoin, people speculating on Bitcoin is people taking the other bet, which is holding dollars, right? And one wins, one loses. It's not like production investment, which is a positive sum game. It's just a zero sum game. There's no net increase in utility or value. If there was only one money, it was just Bitcoin, and people are buying, speculating above, other people are clearly speculating below what the utility is. So they're just guessing. There's no reason to believe that they have better knowledge of what the utility is or will be than the people who actually use it. Right. So it doesn't even help the price get anywhere. It just moves it around. And I'll take the time when we're done to pull up, Rothbard's explanations of these concepts, which are pretty clear. I'm not just making this stuff up. I do make a lot of stuff up, but this is just stuff that's, right out of the textbooks. And I don't, I really try to avoid referencing things like that. It's just appeal to authority, but the proofs are in there, and I'm not going to read them back, so I can refer people to them.
I wanted to ask something about Menger and Mises, but why don't you go ahead, Ben?
So what I see as the utility of money is a medium of exchange, it's a settlement, basically a settlement asset which you can sell and trade with. That exactly goes
medium
to
of exchange.
Cash balances. Yeah, that's good, but that goes to cash balances, basically, not just circulation. I think you're focusing only on the circulation aspect of money, but it also is the cash balances.
those two things you said are the same thing. Settlement is trade, right? That's when you pay somebody for something and they give you the stuff, the trade is settled. If you lend somebody something and they eventually pay you back, it's settled. If you lend a bank your money and then you take it out of the ATM, that's settlement, right? Settlement is when the there's no more debt, right? Mm-hmm. When the debt is relieved. Yeah, so all trades, all loans are settled. So saying it's for settlement but not for trade doesn't really make any sense. And that sounds like what you're saying online before.
What I'm saying is that it's by saying it's settlement, I mean it's for increasing cash balances. It allows you to increase your cash balances in Bitcoin.
Well, yeah, Bitcoin allows you to hold Bitcoin, but that's self-evident, right? I mean, dollars allow you to hold dollars. It doesn't allow you to increase your cash balance. You have to actually earn some money to do that, right? It's just the money.
No.
You can hold it, you can spend it, but, you know.
Yes, but I mean, the demand is not only to spend it, to let it circulate. It's also to save it for use later, basically.
That's an expectation of spending, right? So it's always spending. And this is, again, another pure Austrian concept. Mises said it, Rothbard said it. Money is just a medium of exchange. Everything else is a consequence of that. You know, and I always tell people, you can't store value. You can only store stuff, and stuff may or may not have value in the future when you can trade it with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, but when you hold it, you expect to spend it, of course.
Everything is an expectation of trading.
Yeah, but you're expecting to trade it. Basically, why you're saving it is you expect to trade it with something which is not currently available on the market for a certain deal which you want to make, which is not available mm-hmm. right now on the market. If it was available right now on the market, you would do it now.
Well, it is available on the market often. What you're doing is you're speculating on the price that you'll be able to get it for, right? You want to buy a house. Well, you think the housing prices are going to go down, so you hold some money for a while, and the prices go up, and you say, well, screw it, I'll buy it anyway, right?
Yeah, but what you're doing is you're waiting for the house to be at a price where you want to buy it, basically. It's currently available on the market, but not at a certain price. So what you're doing is just waiting for it to reach a certain price.
That's right. And everybody else is making those same decisions, and the current price reflects the set of all those decisions. So the current price is the only right price, right? Because there is no right price. It's just, I know that didn't make any sense, but price is just what people are willing to trade for. And a speculator argues that, well, he knows better than the rest of the market. And maybe he does have market, information that's not perfect, but, the efficient market hypothesis has been tested many times and it seems to hold up pretty well. If people believed right now that Bitcoin was actually going to be worth, what's the claim? $50,000 in a couple months? Maybe paying a lot more for it right now. They don't actually believe it, right? They're waiting to see it. Because if they did believe it, the price would already be there. So, the market price is the price. And people can guess above and below all they want. But it's always speculation on the ability to trade it for something. It's always about, exchange.
Mm-hmm. Would you elaborate a little bit? I know you talked about this. What's your take on this? The core of Bitcoin, the core principle is that about the absolute scarcity with 21 million. What effect does that have? I mean, what is that in relation to everything?
What effect does it have?
Yeah.
You just want me to talk about scarcity because Bitcoin is the most scarcest. What's your tagline there?
Yeah, yeah. Say hardest and scarcest money ever created. Yes.
All right. Just wanted to hear it. If you missed
let's
it, you
hear
it
because
it
it's for everybody. Because everybody's saying it, so must be something. I mean, otherwise, what's the use if it doesn't have any effect, monetary effect?
Its use is that it's permissionless, not that it's hard. Right. I mean, hard doesn't even have a clear definition. People look at the history of a money, like a dollar, and they say, well, it's, you know, it's got this amount of hardness. It's much better than the Zimbabwe dollar. It's much, much harder. But what makes it harder? Nothing. Just people's choices, right? The history of a money does not determine its future, right? And so you look at, like, the inflation rate of the dollar, and what, you presume that it's always going to be that way? That's the measure of its hardness? No, it could be much softer than that, right? If we use that definition of hardness. And this idea of gold being hard, gold is produced at the rate that people demand it. The more demand, the more production. And the only exceptions are, you know, some discovery of, say, the Comstock lode, which leads to a supply shock. You know, in other words, it gets dramatically cheaper to produce it. But that's not the normal case, right? It's really not been the case with gold, for example, where, and it's not the case with anything else. You know, typically when there's more demand for something, more gets made. And gold gets produced at about the rate of growth in the economy, right? Economic growth, say 2% or so. That's about the rate of production of gold.
Now that's important. Eric, let me ask you this. Okay, it's the inflation rate of gold is approximately 1% to 2% per year. But there's a maximum that can be reached, as you said. I mean, what if they, if technology or the resources are there, or we find something, I don't know, underneath the oceans, you have to put time, energy, and resources into it.
But everything gets produced based on demand or expected demand, right? Entrepreneurs go out and they assume that there's going to be some demand, and they make the stuff before that demand materializes a lot of times. But let's just assume. Initially, there's no change in technology, right? It's the same technological, you know, same tools being used to produce the gold year over year over year. And there's economic growth. Growth is a difference between interest, which is the net of production, and depreciation, which is the loss of stuff over time due to consumption, right? So you take interest minus depreciation, you get growth. And so interest, say, roughly around 10% typically. Depreciation must be around 6 or 7-8% because you get growth around 2%, right? And so growth, by the way, is that number that when people look at a deflationary money or a fixed supply money, they assume constant increase in purchasing power. Well, assuming Bitcoin is the only money in the world, then the growth in purchasing power would be strictly a consequence of the growth in production of the economy. Of course, if nobody's lending it, there's no production. So there wouldn't be any growth, and there wouldn't be any growth in the money. But the growth then, you would assume, would be around 2% per year growth in Bitcoin, which means it would always make sense to lend it because interest would be around 10%, right? And again, if nobody lent it, there'd be no interest, no growth. So let's say the world economy, so we have a gold economy, the world economy is growing at, say, 2%. Well, there's the assumption people make when they say fixed supply creates a deflationary money, the assumption they're making is that the money relation is changing. The ratio of the amount of money, the units of it, and the amount of stuff demanded in it, right? I need the money because I want to buy stuff with it. It's a medium for me to get anything else I want to get, right? So that growth is economic growth, and that supply is the supply of, say, gold. Well, so people accept that assumption when they say Bitcoin is a deflationary money. Okay, so they can't reject it elsewhere. And what happens with production of anything aside from Bitcoin, nothing else is fixed supply. And I think I would more finely argue the point that Bitcoin's really not either, but we'll set that aside, right? When you look at something like gold, and assuming no technological changes, gold is going to increase in demand at about 2% per year if there's no increase in supply. So what happens? The price of gold rises. Now you can produce it for profit. Now people start doing it because they can make more than the interest rate. They can make profit, which is the return on capital above the cost of capital. So they, you know, competition comes in, they mine it, they make more. Well, what are they doing? There's this new demand, right? There's new demand for stuff to mine the gold. Right, that stuff's being destroyed in order to produce the gold. So you've got an increase in demand for stuff, and now you have an increase in supply as well, right? And the stuff is not being invested, so you're also consuming the opportunity cost. So the full amount of the new gold is a consequence of new demand. So there's no change in the money relation. You have new gold, you have new demand, and the gold price will come down to the original price over time because you've created new supply and new demand, right? So the money relation doesn't change. New gold being produced, just like new cars, new anything, is not inflationary, unless there's some technological improvement or some new discovery that allows you to produce it more cheaply. But if it's more cheap to produce gold, it's more cheap to produce everything, right? So that I mean, assuming, right, this is another generalization. But if technology is improving things uniformly, then there's still going to be no change in the money relations, right? The ratio is not going to change. So there has to be a disproportionate change in the efficiency of producing the gold for it to be inflationary, for there to actually be a reduction in the purchasing power of it. Of course, that does happen. I mean, the Comstock lode discovery was a great example. It just became much cheaper to produce silver, and the purchasing power of silver was depressed for a long, long time. So with Bitcoin, new supply never has that problem because new supply is always adjusted for the current cost, right? So whenever you produce more, it costs whatever the current price is. You have to consume that amount of energy, you have to destroy that amount of capital in order to produce Bitcoin. So the new supply, just like the new supply of gold, is always inflation neutral, doesn't cause any change. So the idea that, you know, the reduction in supply, right, the reduction in the rate of the issuance of new Bitcoin somehow makes it more valuable is just incorrect. Right? It doesn't have any effect on it, as it shouldn't. Right? And just like the introduction of new gold doesn't have any effect on the price of gold. So this idea that there's this increasing price because we're reducing the rate of inflation is just incorrect. New Bitcoin is not inflationary. However, once you get to the point where you're not producing any new Bitcoin, right, you have a fixed supply in that one chain, and assuming it's the only money and you have increasing demand because of economic growth, because everybody's lending their Bitcoin and making stuff, then you'll have a growth of purchasing power in the coin of about 2% a year. Right? That you can assume, but those are some pretty big assumptions in there. There's no reason to believe, I mean, there's actually no rationale whatsoever to think it would be any higher than the rate of economic growth, right? So the people who say you can't ever lend a deflationary money because it earns more than interest. Well, it doesn't. It can't, right? Interest always has to be greater than growth by the amount of depreciation. So the only case where that's not true is when you have a recession where interest is actually less than growth, I mean, less than depreciation. So you're actually depreciating, you're destroying more capital than you're producing. It's your classic socialist state, right? It's consuming capital. It's actually not producing more. And eventually it has to actually start producing. So interest rates rise, you know, or people start extending the lifetime of their stuff. Depreciation slows until you actually have growth. So recession is a very exceptional scenario where something's gone wrong, right? Because typically people want stuff. They don't want to have nothing, which is what you'll have with perpetual recession. So interest rates will rise until the point where it becomes worth actually producing stuff for people because they're willing to buy it, and that's why interest rates are rising. Anyway, so that's just a long-winded way of saying, yeah, you can always lend any money, and the expected deflation rate of a fixed supply money, assuming it's the only money, is the rate of economic growth. And new production of new money or new anything, barring technological changes, is not inflationary. Summary points. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you something about gold? Because there was this discussion during your presentation in Riga where you said a certain percentage is used as jewelry. And I don't know about the industrial usage. This is my question. Does the demand of this whatever 1-2% yearly of gold production come from the industrial usage or industrial demand, or where does it come from?
You can't split that out. I mean, it's just demand, but the usage of gold, is more than, it's right around 50%, maybe 51% goes to jewelry every year. And I think a couple guys on the panel disagree with that. And there was a guy in the back of the audience that yelled, no, it's not, you know. And it turns out he contacted me later and he gave a presentation later at Riga about that very subject. And he said I was absolutely correct. And I knew I was correct. I've read it many times. And,
so it's really 51% jewelry? Is that really? Is that, I thought it's
It's not hard to find. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And then you get a much, much, much smaller percentage that's actually industrial use. Mm-hmm. So when states hoard money, they don't hoard their own paper, right? Because they have the ability to print as much as they want. So no other state will take it in time of war or need or anything like that, right? They don't want their own paper because they can just print as much as they want. And they don't want somebody else's paper for the same reason. So they have to hoard something else, right? So why do they hoard gold? Well, gold's value is, it's gold has use value, right? So it's not just, you know, at least half, more than half, well more than half of the uses of gold right now, of new gold produced, is use value, not monetary value. So there's this presumption that, you know, it will always have some value because it's not just based on, it's not fiat. It's not like Bitcoin. It's not like dollars. It's not just based on what anybody's willing to trade for it. I mean, ultimately the same is true of jewelry, right? But it has actual use value. You could take it out of the vault and make your own jewelry with it if you wanted. You'd be perfectly happy.
Ben, what's your take? Do you argue? Are you arguing?
No, here I guess I mostly agree. So I do think there is a monetary premium even on jewelry and stuff. So I do think it's even the use of gold as jewelry is, at least in some places, I heard some like India and stuff. So it is used even if it's in a form of jewelry as money in certain cases. But yeah, I generally agree.
Well, you have to understand that's true of all things. Right. In Venezuela, they use stereos and TVs as money. Right? They store electronics, even though they depreciate pretty rapidly. They depreciate a lot slower than the Venezuelan bolivar, the new bolivar. Everything has some aspect of monetary use. It's not really an exception. People store their value in different ways, or you know, to the extent that value can be stored. Right? They store their capital that they expect to spend later in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. People do it with cars, they do it with houses, they do it with artwork, you know, all kinds of things. Basically anything you have that you don't expect to fully consume, you assume you can liquidate and get other stuff for. And gold is just an efficient way to do that, but it's really not unique to gold. So
yeah,
separating out.
I didn't say it's unique to gold. I'm not saying it's unique to gold, but it's,
yeah.
I mean, most things, my computer doesn't have much monitor premium, I guess. Maybe it would if we were in a hyperinflation case here, but for now it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, the benefit of gold is it's something with use value that doesn't decay very rapidly, right? Mm-hmm. So it has a carry cost, like everything else, but it's very compact. And it doesn't depreciate very rapidly. The depreciation of gold is essentially the demurrage, the cost of securing it, and the opportunity cost of not lending it. But that's a different type of cost.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ben.
What else you got, Kayvon? How much is Alina gonna owe me for this?
So guys,
can we put a number on that?
No, I don't. I don't.
One
dare
Bitcoin.
To. I don't want to be attacked. I don't want to be attacked.
Take some risk, man.
Are we over 1 hour, or have we done an hour or so? I think so. So Ben, do you have any other questions, or do you have any counter arguments discussion?
Not on the recent, on the recent takes. I still, what I'm saying is that I still think the use of money for us, holding it as cash balances is a valid use. I mean, of course, it's much better, it's a lower time preference activity to lend it or invest it. But I still think that in order to adopt Bitcoin, we should also desire it in our cash balances. And as more people want it, they will be more willing to accept it. And it will actually be able to circulate. That's my argument.
Yeah, my take is that it's always held by someone. So that's kind of a tautological, right? All property is held by somebody. So the question is, what are we going to do with it?
Okay, but,
yeah, it just depends on how many, I guess, hold it.
Well, if we take the same amount of money and we divide it by 1 million people or 1,000 people, it doesn't imply any different value.
The value is going to come. Effects, basically. It implies because
but there's no network.
I mean, if a million people use certain money, it's much more useful than if 1,000 people use it.
Well, you say use, something's implied, you know, trading, right? If they just hold it, right? If you have 1 million people holding it, or you have 1,000 people holding it, it makes no difference. Everybody's just holding it. It has no price even. If you have one person holding it and, you know, millions of people accepting it, right? It has real value to that person, right? Say one person holds most of the gold, right? If nobody accepts it, it's worth nothing. If lots of people accept it, it's worth a lot. It's not a function of how many people hold it. It's a function of how many people will accept it, which is people who want to hold it, right? But if nobody is accepting it,
yes.
It's not, I mean, you can't buy much with it. It's not worth much, right? The network is between merchants, not between hodlers.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but not really, because hodlers also accept it, or most hodlers
they're merchants. If they're not accepting it, they're not securing it, right? Because they don't have any say in the consensus rules, and they're not providing part of the network of people that will trade for it, right? So they're not actually providing value to people who have it. The idea of everybody just holding it and therefore it's way valuable is kind of silly. Right?
You have to use it. Of course, you have to like to use it, to spend it. That's obvious. But
you can't. Spend it if nobody accepts it.
That you're spending it.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I get it. Okay.
That's circular, I guess.
Okay, I get it. Okay. So my question is, once I call it a transactional or the buying and selling, just really simply the Lightning Network, the transactional ecosystem is really much more developed. Do you think it will then, because of the usability of the easiness of use, will facilitate and accelerate the demand? Exactly what we're talking about, Eric. What will increase and accelerate the demand and accepting as a trading values?
Yeah, if it's easier to use in the scenarios where it will actually be usable, I think it will increase its. I mean, it does. That implies it has higher utility, right? It's easier to use. I mean, people assume that there's like no alternatives, right? Like people can't use anything else; they just have to use Bitcoin. But there's tons of alternatives to Bitcoin, and there's some that are very similar to Bitcoin, and people will use those alternatives to the extent that they're cheaper for them in their scenario, right? I mean. You know, there's not a Bitcoin ATM out in front of the strip clubs, right? It's not very useful. Like nobody's taking it. You can't throw it on the floor or whatever. Right? So there's just cases where it's useful and there's cases where it's not. And the easier you can make it, presumably it's more useful in more scenarios. The more private you can make it, I think. I mean, to me, that's the most important thing that that core development is working on. Ease of use is basically what I work on, right? The Bitcoin is a library for people to. And it's not. We're not innovating new privacy tech, not really. Some people have contributed some stuff, but I just wait for that stuff to come along and then we incorporate it into the library so people can build stuff more easily. That's real Bitcoin stuff, not using some web API that's running tens of thousands or millions of people's wallets. Basically, one merchant in the graph, right? You want a lot of people to accept it. Individually with their own control over the consensus rules. And the easier you can make that. I mean, Casa's doing good work in the space, I think Trezor, those guys as well. Those are important things. You need to be able to run your own stuff easily as possible. And
What about the coin joining?
You need privacy.
Yeah. So this is built
because
out.
The scenarios where Bitcoin is, I mean, it's permissionless, right? If it's not private, it's not permissionless.
Right.
So those are the two important areas where, you know, I think all real core development is focused, and I think, you know, it's great. Other stuff I don't find very valuable. You know, basically driving adoption into white market, you know, institutions and centralizing APIs and things like that. They're just counterproductive, right? And they give this appearance of value, and then people speculate on that appearance. You know, to me, price is not the critical thing in Bitcoin. It implies use, but if the use is easily wiped out, it's just a charade. But the price is permissioned, I should say, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, it'll get there one way or the other. I'm not worried about that. That's why I work on it. I'm not negative on Bitcoin. I just think people should understand that. If people understood some of these things a little better, then we'd waste less time. Mm-hmm. Less capital would flow into stuff that's kind of pointless. Risk-free lending, it's one of my pet peeves. getting rid of, you know, fractional reserve, getting rid of credit expansion, you know, risk-free lending. There's all these banking fallacies that drive a lot of attention and capital, and it's just wasted. That's really why I focus on these topics. I just want people to invest in the things that make sense.
Ben, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mostly agree. I do see use for Bitcoin even in the white market. Maybe not as large. So I wouldn't say that it's counterproductive to build stuff also for the white market. I'm not sure. I mean, it can be, maybe I will be wrong about that, but I don't think it will completely vanish from the white market eventually. I still think it will circulate even in the white market.
Well, if it's illegal, it won't, because by definition, it'll be black market. And all that takes is a law.
There's difference between illegal and restricted. That's what I think.
I don't make that fine point. If it's restricted, what the part that is restricted is illegal. For example, people believe they can avoid seigniorage with Bitcoin. They can hodl their Bitcoin and never pay the inflation tax. Let's just say they're American. The dollar drops, you know, by half. They just got a 100% capital gains tax, right? Or they just got a capital gains tax. When they go to use their Bitcoin, right? When they spend it, they're going to have to take the dollar value of whatever they spend it on, subtract their basis, and they're going to have to pay a tax on that. That tax is seigniorage, right? They're not avoiding it unless they break that law, right? And I'm not encouraging them to do so, mind you, but I'm just suggesting that it's already illegal to get that benefit. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not the full amount, right? If seigniorage would be 100% of that, your tax is going to be whatever the percentage of the capital gain is, maybe 20, 30, 40%, 50% maybe if you're in California or New York. But it's still, you're paying it. Now people are getting, I got a letter from the IRS. I actually got two telling me that they know I have Bitcoin and I may owe a tax, right? And then I got kicked off of Coinbase for who knows what reason. I had it for like 6 years. I just had a dollar cost average going, and they just said, no, you're too risky. I guess, I don't know. They didn't tell me why. So it's not like these things, I mean, Coinbase doesn't care, right? They don't want to kick people off who are buying Bitcoin. That's being driven by law, and they're probably their automated process is trying to figure out what the risk is for them being determined to be money laundering. So there's some kind of assumption that these things aren't already, you know, issues, but they are. You know, the on-ramps and off-ramps are all being targeted, and that's just the low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're kind of already there. You know, I always tell people we're still in the honeymoon phase, because kind of you can do a lot of stuff publicly with Bitcoin. And kind of ignoring some big stuff that's already there.
So do you think this process of, is it going to clamp down? Like, it's going to become much more strict, much more enforceable, or I don't know, they're going really to...
It's very enforceable. That's not, you know, maybe you just misspoke, but it's, you know, always enforceable. The question is, to what extent do they want to do it? And I don't make predictions about, you know, when things will happen, or even if they'll happen, just that if they want to, if Bitcoin becomes valuable enough, presumably somebody will care. In other words, if it's got enough utility, it's really saving people tax money. Like, they're not paying, you know, when the Zimbabwe bond notes start going to zero again, you know, they renamed them. They were the dollar for the last four iterations. So now they're bond notes. And I bought one and I'm waiting for it to go to zero. It only cost me a dollar. Bought it in the Zimbabwe bank. And I asked one of the local guys, I said, what's going to happen with this? And he put up his hands and he went like this. And I was like, he gets it, right? He knows what they're doing. So when that happens, you know, I'll be ready. Cash out my Zimbabwe dollar in time. But yeah, these things, when that happens and everybody starts using Bitcoin in Zimbabwe, what are they going to do? No, they might do nothing. They might just eliminate their ability to tax via the money. They just say, we give up. We've been doing this for, you know, five iterations now under one dictator, but I guess he's gone now. But you know, they do have that option to just surrender their taxing ability through the money, and their ability to see what everybody's doing, you know, assuming decent privacy. But presumably, if they care, they will do the easiest thing, which is to sign a piece of paper and say you can't do this unless you make these rule changes, which make it the ideal state money, which defeats the value proposition. At that point, anybody who accepts it is a money launderer, including miners. That's very easy to do, and it's very easy to enforce in the white market, right? Because the white market doesn't resist. They're the ones that accept the law. So forcing it in the black market's a different story. And as you probably know, the next step is go to a 51% attack. If you have enough willpower, it's really not that expensive because it's profitable. So you move into a profitable regime of mining. And run a, you know, effectively that's all a soft fork is, right? It's 51% attack. It's a minor enforced soft fork, just refusing to build on other blocks that don't honor the restrictions. So, you know, and people have achieved that. So it's very doable. And if the black market economy wants to pay for, you know, higher hash rate, that's mining unapproved transactions, unauthorized transactions, then Bitcoin can survive that. That's not really knowable.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. Ben, did you want to say something in conclusion or comments?
No, I just think Bitcoin, I hope it will. A lot of this talk is somewhat pessimistic, but I think I want to make it clear that I do think Bitcoin can survive. That I guess Eric thinks like that too, and that's why he works on the Bitcoin.
Exactly.
I just want to make this clear.
Yeah, he's a realist. He's a realist. Eric is a realist. He's
rationalist.
A rationalist. Yeah, so true. No, we're really thankful, Eric, for your, you know, really rigid, logical, rational elaborations.
I thank you for putting up with me all the time, Kayvon.
No,
it's almost 4 in the morning over here, so you know, I get a little punchy.
What are you drinking? Are you drinking beer right now to go to sleep, or a juice?
Pale ale.
Oh, pale ale. Very healthy. Very healthy.
Yeah, Washington Trails.
So, Eric, are you going to be at the Lightning Conference in Berlin? You don't?
No.
Okay,
no.
Let's see you next time then. All right. Well, see you, Ben, in Berlin. And thank you so much for this discussion. I learned so much, and my listeners, viewers, hopefully will trigger some discussion. A lot of people will feel triggered. I already see that, but it's okay. It's part of the process.
Yeah. Nice meeting you, Ben.
Yeah, nice meeting you too. Thanks for the discussion. No. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Kevan.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
Welcome to the podcast show by Kevan Devani, The Total Connector, Total Bitcoin, Austrian Economics, the hardest and scarcest money ever created in human history, Bitcoin.